So again, in this session, we're going to go back to the compassion wing of the practice. And so every afternoon in the 2 o'clock session, we're going to balance the shamatha practice by looking at the compassion wing of the practice. And in the compassion wing of the practice, we're focusing mainly on what's called the four immeasurables. These are four qualities that we're trying to cultivate towards immeasurable sentient beings, towards all living beings. And the first one we looked at yesterday was loving kindness. Or in Sanskrit, it's Maitri, in Pali, Metta. And we saw here that loving kindness is simply the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. Or in other words, the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. And so immeasurable loving kindness is the wish for all living beings to have happiness and its causes. And we saw there that it's better to translate the word maitri or metta as loving kindness rather than the word love. Because the word love, usually in English language, the word love, of course, is an emotion, and it usually involves some sort of intimate behaviour. Whereas here, this loving kindness is not really even an emotion, and it's certainly not a behaviour. It's simply an aspiration, an attitude. It's a wish. It's an aspiration for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. Very closely related to that, and that's what we're going to be looking at today, is compassion. In Sanskrit and Pali, karuna. And compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. So just as with loving kindness yesterday, where we talked about the wish for happiness, we really need to understand what we mean by happiness, of course. You know, generally we often identify pleasure with happiness. So our pursuit of happiness is simply a pursuit of pleasure. And we chase after a lot of pleasurable experiences. So that's, of course, not going to really fulfill us, and it's just going to bring a lot of frustration, disappointment, and so forth in our life. So if we really want to develop loving kindness towards ourselves and others, the pursuit of happiness, we need to really understand we're talking more about genuine happiness, this inner sense of well-being, that's the aspiration towards this. Likewise, in compassion, which is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes, there also we need to understand what we mean by suffering and what are the causes of suffering. Because otherwise, like with happiness, we simply induce a lot of unnecessary suffering. Because again, here we tend to feel as if things outside of ourselves are the sources of suffering. And so, as with the happiness, where we try to attract and hold on to pleasant things, with suffering, we identify unpleasant experiences with suffering, and so then we just simply try and push away or avoid unpleasant experiences. And of course, that aversion to these unpleasant experiences, all that really does is induce a lot more unnecessary suffering. So here also, we need to understand that really that what is the underlying source of suffering? And it's not really out there, it's also within ourselves. So from a Buddhist perspective, the underlying source of our suffering lies within our own mind, as does the source of our happiness. So if we want to really develop compassion for ourselves and others, we really need to begin to appreciate this. Otherwise, we're simply going to have aversion to unpleasant experiences and simply induce a lot of unnecessary suffering. And it's certainly, from a Buddhist perspective, it's really our mental afflictions that are identified as the real underlying source of our suffering. Things like anger and jealousy and craving and fear, anxiety, depression, greed and all these. It's all these mental afflictions that really are the source of our suffering. And what we can understand, of course, is that we can overcome these mental afflictions. So like loving kindness, compassion is not really an emotion. Compassion is also an aspiration, it's a wish, it's an aspiration for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. So, of course, one of the precursors to compassion is an emotion called empathy. And so with empathy, we identify or we can relate to not only our own suffering, but the suffering of others. So, but of course, if we believe that the source of suffering is out there, well, there's not much we can do about the things around us. So usually then, when we have this empathy, and see that the source of suffering seems to be coming from out there, and we see we can't really do much about that, we have this idea there's no hope about suffering. And that simply leads to despair. We just despair about suffering. Whereas with this empathy relating to others, and then really understanding that the source of suffering is coming from within our own mind with the mental afflictions, and that there's something actually we can do about the mental afflictions, we can reduce and eliminate them. With that understanding, then when we have empathy with regard to our own and others' suffering, then we have hope that we can do something about that. And that really leads to then this compassionate aspiration that may I and others actually be free of suffering and its causes. So this is something important to understand. And so like with loving kindness, in cultivating compassion, we also cultivate compassion in stages. So here, of course, we're talking about cultivating immeasurable compassion, having compassion for all living beings. But as with loving kindness, it's best to cultivate that in stages. First, in the text, it talks about cultivating compassion to our friends, people close to us, easiest. Then expanding it out to people we don't know very well, and then slowly expanding it out to people who we find a little bit difficult, and then eventually to all living beings. But as with the loving kindness, I think in our modern society, we need to add an extra step, and that is to have compassion for ourselves. Because unfortunately, in our modern society, there seems to be this epidemic of low self-esteem and self-hatred. And so if we're not really kind and compassionate towards ourselves, we're not going to be able to extend it out to others. So we're going to do a compassion practice. Again, going through some of these stages of cultivating compassion first for ourselves and then slowly expanding out to others. Now, to talk a little bit about the practice before we go into it, I'll read a little bit again from Alan Wallace's book here, and he talks about this compassion practice on page 39, and he says the following. When you start to experience the inner calm, simplicity and quietude of shamatha practice, you may become attached to this state of mind, and that can result in apathetic indifference to those around you and the world at large. You've got your own quiet space of serenity, and you may not want to be disturbed. The worthy venture of meditative training becomes derailed when it results in such complacency. It can become little more than a substitute for Prozac or Valium. The real aim of this practice is to cultivate mental balance that results in genuine happiness, and indifference to others is not a sign of genuine happiness or mental health. While some people become attached to the feelings of calm they experience through shamatha practice, others may become dissatisfied with their progress and become bored with the practice. This training usually does not provide swift gratification or immediate results. It can lead to exceptional mental health and well-being, but this takes time and effort. Rather than suppressing the symptoms of an imbalanced mind by losing ourselves in work or entertainment, we can engage in our practice and go to the root of the problem and cultivate our minds. The word meditation in the modern world often has the connotation of doing something special to calm the mind or try to achieve some altered state of consciousness. But the Sanskrit word for meditation is bhavana, which simply means cultivation. In fact, we are all cultivating our minds in one way or another all the time, through the way we use our attention. The quality of our lives reflects the ways we have cultivated our minds until now. Impediment to mental balance that are especially common in the West are self-judgment, guilt, and low self-esteem. As we practice, we may do so with a certain level of expectation. Then if we don't progress as well as we think we should, we may grow impatient with ourselves and feel guilty when we don't take time to practice. One more failure to add to our list. In attentional training, we are going against the grain of years of habit, let alone eons of biological evolution that have helped us survive and procreate, but have done little to prepare us for such serene, focused attention. So it's no wonder that our minds are so scattered and prone to imbalances of all kinds. But with gentle patience, we can gradually train our minds so that they provide us with an inner sense of well-being, instead of constant anxiety, dissatisfaction, and restlessness. This requires compassion for ourselves and for others. The first step is to begin identifying the real causes of our discontent. Virtually anything may catalyze unhappiness, but its true source is always in the mind. Some people feel desperately miserable even when their outer circumstances are wonderful, while others are happy and contented even in the face of dire adversity. We suffer because our minds are afflicted by various kinds of imbalances, which lead us to seek happiness in all the wrong places. But we can emerge from this hedonic treadmill by identifying what truly ails us and what truly brings us satisfaction. Buddhists refer to this shift in priorities as the arousal of a spirit of emergence, with which we move away from the sources of discontent and set out on the path to genuine happiness. This is the most compassionate thing we can do for ourselves. None of us lives in isolation, no matter how lonely or alienated we may feel at times. Our welfare is intimately linked to everyone around us, especially those with whom we are in frequent contact. As we learn to be compassionate and non-judgmental toward ourselves, it is only natural to extend this gentle heart to others. This begins with empathy, feeling with the joys and sorrows, successes and failures of our loved ones, associates, and even strangers. This is the fertile ground from which the seed of compassion sprouts. Empathy and compassion are not the same. Compassion is not simply feeling sorry for someone. Compassion goes beyond empathy to the heartfelt yearning. May you be free of suffering and its causes. How may I help? Okay. So with that in mind then, we're going to do one 24-minute session on cultivating compassion for ourselves and then starting to expand that out to others. And then after the meditation, I'd like to address at least two questions. One is, why do we find it so difficult to have forgiveness and compassion for those who behave badly? the so-called enemy. And the other one is, why is there, in fact, seems to be an epidemic of low self-esteem and self-hatred? And so I'm going to try to answer those questions after the meditation. But first, let's do the meditation. So simply allow your awareness to descend into the body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. And we can begin by cultivating compassion for ourselves and then extending it out to others. And so again, we can begin by imagining this inner purity of our mind, our Buddha nature. Imagining this as a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of our chest at the level of our heart. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I were free of suffering and its causes. May I be free of all suffering and its causes. May I be free of all mental afflictions. And then imagine your mental afflictions and any present or future suffering in the form of black smoke filling your body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing your suffering and mental afflictions at your heart, dissolving them into your inner wisdom, your inner purity of mind. And then imagine the black cloud is completely extinguished, and now you're completely free of all mental afflictions and suffering. And take delight in this. And then next bring to mind someone close to you, a loved one, who's currently experiencing some sort of physical or mental problem or suffering. And imagine them very clearly in front of you. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they were free of that problem, free of that suffering. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine their problem or suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And then imagine that black cloud is completely extinguished. And now your loved one is completely free of that problem, free of that suffering. And take joy in this. And then allow your field of compassion to expand out to the person seated next to you. They are also like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they are free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. May you be free of all mental afflictions. And then imagine their mental afflictions and suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, Breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their mental afflictions and suffering at your heart. And imagine that the black cloud is now completely extinguished. And now they're completely free of all mental afflictions and suffering. And take delight in this. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply be present. Simply be aware of being aware. So with this cultivation of compassion, it's often not too difficult to cultivate that for our friends. Maybe a little bit more difficult to cultivate for people we don't know very well. But often it becomes very difficult to cultivate for people who really behave badly. People who engage in harmful behaviour, particularly people who try to harm us or people close to us. And also actually sometimes it's difficult to even cultivate this compassion for ourselves because often we don't feel like we deserve it. So why is it that it's so difficult to cultivate compassion for people who behave badly? And I think there's one very good reason. The correct perspective, of course, is to simply see there's a person who's doing a bad or harmful action or behaviour. So this is the correct perspective. But often when we see someone engaging in some harmful sort of behaviour, we don't often tend to have that perspective. Rather, we simply see there's a bad person, an evil person, a nasty person, a horrible person. And so what we've done here, of course, is we have fused the person to their behaviour and made them one thing. And in psychology, this is called cognitive fusion. So, of course, fusion means to fuse two things to make them one, and cognitive means to mentally do that. So we mentally fuse the person to their behaviour. And if we do that, and we often do that, that leads to a lot of difficulties. Because in any given situation, we've got two options for that situation, either accept or reject. Normally, of course, if someone's behaving badly, we reject. But of course, if we do cognitive fusion and we fuse the person to their behaviour and we reject, what we end up doing is rejecting the person. We attack the person. We get angry at the person, hostile. But of course, if we understand that attacking people or getting angry at people or hostile towards people or hating people is not really the right thing to do, but then if we do cognitive fusion and we don't, and we feel that that's not the right thing to do, then the only other option left is accept. And if we fuse the person to the behaviour, we simply end up accepting their bad behaviour. Which, of course, is not okay. So if we do cognitive fusion, these are really the only two options open to us. Reject, we end up rejecting the person, attacking the person, or accept, we end up accepting their bad behaviour. And so, of course, both of those are not helpful. And also then, of course, when it comes to talk about forgiveness or compassion, to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying is, oh, what you did is okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind what they did. It's not acceptable. So therefore, it becomes almost impossible to have forgiveness or compassion if we do cognitive fusion, because we feel like they don't deserve it, that somehow we are condoning or accepting their bad behaviour if we have forgiveness or compassion for them. Also, of course, if we do this cognitive fusion, if we fuse the person to their behaviour and we see them as a bad person, then we end up with a fixed, biased view of that person. Because all people, of course, have some good behaviour and some not so good behaviour. But if we identify a person with their negative behaviour and we see them as a bad person, then of course bad people don't do good things. So we have a completely biased view of that person. They're just a bad person. And then often what happens, of course, is if this person does something good, we sort of brush it off. We say, well, they didn't really mean to do that. They're not really a nice person. They didn't really mean it. So therefore, we tend to have a biased view of that person as well. So of course, the simple solution to all of this is to not do cognitive fusion. Because cognitive fusion is a false perspective. We should simply see the situation in the correct way. And that is to simply acknowledge there is a person doing or engaging in some harmful or negative behaviour. And if we do that, then of course we can have compassion for the person. So we can accept the person, but at the same time, not accept their bad behaviour and address their bad behaviour. So we can be very firm about their negative behaviour and not accept it, and at the same time have compassion for the person. And then also, of course, we don't end up with this fixed, biased view of the person. So, unfortunately, in our society and the way we've grown up, we've tend to have grown up and use this sort of language. We tend to identify people with their behaviours a lot. And so we end up doing this cognitive fusion in the way we speak and think a lot. And that's why we have so much difficulty in this area. So this also applies to ourselves. Because also what we tend to do is if we have done a negative behaviour, then the correct perspective is to simply acknowledge I have done some bad or harmful action. But again, what we often do is we don't have that perspective, we do cognitive fusion, and we simply think, I am a bad person. So again, we identify ourselves with our behaviour. And so, of course, if we identify ourselves with our bad behaviour, then often we don't like our bad behaviour, but if we do cognitive fusion, we end up attacking ourselves. We beat ourselves up. We have self-hatred. And then also, of course, sometimes if we don't want to do that, we simply accept our bad behaviour, which also, of course, is not okay. Also, of course, if we do this, we end up with this fixed, biased view of ourselves. I'm just a bad person. Of course, we, like everyone else, sometimes do good things and sometimes not so good things. But if we identify ourselves with our bad behaviour, then we have this biased view that I'm just a bad person. And so no wonder, of course, then we end up with low self-esteem, self-judgment and self-hatred. So again, forgiveness and compassion for ourselves becomes difficult because we feel like we don't deserve it. You know, I'm just a bad person. I don't deserve forgiveness or compassion. Actually, there's no such thing as a bad person. There's only people who sometimes engage in bad, harmful behaviour. And so we need to acknowledge that ourselves as well, is that if we have done a bad action, it's to simply acknowledge, I have done a harmful or negative behaviour. Then we can still feel good about ourselves, have self-esteem and have compassion for ourselves and address our negative behaviour, look at ways of overcoming our negative behaviour. And this also highlights the difference between regret and guilt. Guilt is also coming from cognitive fusion.
When we feel guilty about something, what are we focusing on? Bad me. Bad me. So guilt comes from cognitive fusion, from a false perspective. Guilt is completely useless. All it does is it makes us feel bad and it paralyzes us. And it's not even addressing the negative behavior. So we don't need to feel guilty about anything. Unfortunately, guilt seems to have been used over the centuries as a way of having control over people, because it really does paralyze people and make them feel bad. But it really is not helpful at all. Whereas regret is based on the correct perspective. If we've done something harmful and we regret, what are we regretting? We're regretting the bad behavior. So regret comes from the correct perspective. Simply acknowledging, I have done this negative behavior, then we can have compassion for ourselves and address our negative bad behavior. Look at ways of overcoming it. So, therefore, a lot of our difficulties in terms of low self-esteem, guilt and self-hatred, a lot of our difficulties in terms of not being able to have compassion and forgiveness for people who behave badly is simply because of this, that we are simply engaging in this cognitive fusion, and this is something that we need to overcome because it's a false perspective. There are two things here. There's not one thing. There's a person and their behavior. Similarly, we not only identify ourselves with our behavior, and unfortunately in our modern society we tend to always identify with the negative and not the positive. We not only identify ourselves with our negative behavior, we identify ourselves with our negative thoughts, our negative emotions, and so forth. And so we see ourselves as, you know, how often do you hear people say, I'm an angry person, that's me, you better accept that. There's no such thing as an angry person. There's only people who have a habit of being angry. So, but if we identify ourselves with any of our thoughts, emotions, behaviors, habits, and so forth, we're stuck. We have a fixed biased view of ourselves, and we tend to only identify ourselves with the negative aspects of ourselves, and therefore, of course, we'll have low self-esteem, self-hatred. And if we do that with others, we're simply going to attack others, we're going to judge others, and we're not going to be able to have forgiveness or compassion for others as well. So, of course, we are not our behaviors. We are not our thoughts. Either we are our thoughts or we have thoughts. We can't be our thoughts and have thoughts. So we have thoughts. Either we are our emotions or we have emotions. We have emotions, so we're not our emotions. Either we are our behavior or we have behavior. We have behavior. Either we are our habits or we have habits. We have habits. And either we are our personality or we have a personality. These are all things which we have. We have thoughts, we have emotions, we have habits, we have behaviors, we have personalities, which means they're not us, which means that we can change all of these things. So, but if we identify ourselves with any of these things, and again, unfortunately, in our modern society, we always tend to identify with the negative aspects of ourselves, then, of course, we're definitely going to have low self-esteem, self-hatred. We're not going to have any forgiveness or compassion for ourselves. We're not going to feel good about ourselves. So I think that's something that can be very helpful. And so we really need to reprogram the way we speak and think to avoid this cognitive fusion. And then I think things will work a lot better. We'll be able to be having good self-esteem. We'll be able to have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves. And we'll also begin to have forgiveness and compassion for others, particularly those who behave badly. And then also then address their negative behavior and address any negative behavior that we are engaging in. Normally we leave questions till the later session, but I think this is very important. So is there anyone who has any questions about this now? Maybe it would be the right time to bring it up.
But it doesn't mean that I should identify with my positive habits too, because it's also
Yes, yes. That's a very good point, is that we should also not identify with the positive habits. I mean, probably identifying positive habits will give maybe... Identifying negative habits often has a bigger, heavier consequence. But even identifying with positive habits is not helpful for a number of reasons. One is that we then sometimes, because we identify with them, we end up with this puffed up state of mind thinking we're better than everyone else. So you can get a lot of pride and arrogance. And also, of course, then because we've identified with those, we tend to not acknowledge negative behaviours, you know, and so we tend to not acknowledge them or see them, and same in others. And also, for example, the classic example here is praise. If someone is engaging in some good behaviour, what we often do, of course, is we praise the person. You're a fantastic person, fantastic person. But again, that's not very helpful, because all it does is it gives them a puffed up state of mind thinking they're special. Whereas what we should do is we should praise their behaviour. So instead of saying you're a fantastic person, we should say that action you did was really wonderful. Your behaviour is really wonderful. Because that will then make them feel good about themselves and encourage them to continue to engage in that positive behaviour. So therefore, the correct perspective is when someone's engaging in good behaviour is to acknowledge and praise their behaviour. Similarly with ourselves, if we do something good, we must acknowledge and praise our good behaviour. But identifying ourselves with our good behaviour can lead to sort of pride and arrogance and a puffed up state of mind. And unfortunately this is sometimes used to help, because there's such an epidemic of low self-esteem, sometimes we find that being used as a way of being the opposite. You know, if a little child has low self-esteem, you know, the parent says, oh, but you're a fantastic, you're special, you're a special person, you're a wonderful person. And of course the child can never live up to that. And so when they can't, then it makes them feel even worse. So therefore, both on the positive and negative, the cognitive fusion can lead to problems. So, therefore, also on the positive side is to not do this identification, but rather acknowledge our own and others' good habits and good behaviours and praise our own and others' good habits and behaviours. Then we have a balanced view of ourselves and others.
Our mental afflictions, which may come from right ignorance, very often certain negative behavior, even though it's addressed with compassion, it's being repeated and repeated and repeated, whether by
ourselves
or by someone close to us or someone who has something that can affect
sure.
us. Okay, so how do we get around it? I mean, okay, once, twice, you have compassion for yourself or for someone else who is doing a negative behavior, however, as due to some mental afflictions that are very, very ingrained within our mind, so this negative behavior continues to occur.
Sure.
So do we need to kind of stop those?
No. No. So, of course, if someone is behaving... see, this is why it's important not to do cognitive fusion, because... if we do cognitive fusion and we want to have compassion for others, we end up accepting their bad behaviour, because then compassion has no wisdom. Compassion is, oh, it's okay, it's okay, don't worry. You know, that's not good for that person or for ourselves. So that's why often people feel that compassion is a sign of weakness, because they're thinking in this way and then compassion ends up this. But that's not compassion. That's ignorance. So compassion really comes from the correct perspective. And so actually compassion is a sign of strength, whereas anger or hatred is a sign of weakness. Compassion is a sign of strength, and with compassion, of course, we address their bad behaviour. So with compassion, of course, you always have to have wisdom. Particularly when you want to address their bad behaviour, you need to understand how to help that person.
And sometimes this compassion can be very forceful. You know, if that person is engaging in some violent physical behavior, then with compassion, we can use physical force to restrain that person, because that may be what's necessary to do. So therefore, depending on the behavior and their habit, that compassion can be very forceful. But of course, if we're talking about someone else who has strong habit, then of course, even within ourselves, strong habits are hard to change. So there's no magic wand we can wave that will stop that person from behaving in that negative way. But at least if we approach it like this, we have a better chance of helping that person than if we do this. Because if we do this, we attack the person, they'll just get worse, and that's not going to help at all. That's certainly not going to help. Whereas if we use this approach, we have some chance of helping a person. But of course, we can't make a person change. It's up to them. All we can do is use wisdom and compassion to first to show to them how their behavior is very harmful, and then hopefully help them to overcome that negative behavior. But of course, if it's a very strong habit, it's not easy, it's difficult.
But what I mean is that if actually the habit is very strong and we've tried to help them, but it's a bit hopeless, then their negative behavior affects us back, right? So if we are unable to, in a way, it does, let's say, if we are unable to help them, this means that we need to kind of distance from that person in order to basically save ourselves from an unnecessary...
Yeah, that's part of wisdom, of course. You know, if we're in a situation where really we can't help and it's just overwhelming us, then part of our wisdom and our compassion is saying, well, you know, I think at the moment the best thing for me to do is to step back from this, because otherwise I'm just going to be affected in a negative way and the other person is, and so trying to do something at this point in time is not going to work. But that doesn't mean we give up compassion for them. It just means that we adopt some other behavior in terms of maybe stepping back for the moment. So we're not talking about abandoning compassion, we're just talking about adjusting our behavior. Okay, 3 o'clock, time for afternoon tea break, so let's have a break and then we'll come back at 3:30 back to the shamatha practice.